This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Sorry I Missed You by Susie Kraus, performed by Amanda Ronconi. Ghosting Stories. Maud and Richard. It was Maud's wedding day, and she looked awful in her dress. It bunched and sagged and pillowed and bulged. It washed her out while somehow also accentuating what was, in Maud's mind, her worst feature, her face. Richard wouldn't care. She knew this because she looked awful in everything, and he never cared, or even seemed to notice. He didn't really talk about how she looked. But he wasn't one of those skeezy older men who talked about how other women looked, either. Instead, he laughed hard at her jokes, engaged her in enriching conversation, made her extravagant meals, and held her hand proudly in public. He absently played with her hair while they watched movies as though it were long and soft rather than short and wiry. He touched her face affectionately when he told her he loved her, and his eyes crinkled at the sides like he couldn't believe he was so lucky. When this happened, she always felt her eyes do the same thing. Maud smiled into the full-length mirror, aghast at all those lines. It was definitely harder to look good in fancy things when you were in your 60s. Not impossible, just harder than it was when you were 25. You could do all the squats you wanted, walk 10 miles every day, apply moisturizer with a fire hose. Didn't matter. You lived in your body, and it showed. For the first time in her life, Maud wished she'd gotten married in her early 20s. This dress was meant for that bride. But then she thought about the kind of man she would have chosen back then, and she laughed out loud and decided not to worry about her face or her bulging midsection and enjoy the fact that she was in actual mutual love. Maybe deciding not to worry was one of the few things that came easier when you were in your 60s. And so, gathering up her courage and multiple layers of tulle and satin, she boarded a bus to the park beside the courthouse downtown, where they were to meet their photographer before the ceremony, Richard's idea. The people on the bus stared at her curiously, and she smiled back, unbothered. "Maybe they think I look beautiful," she thought. And before she could dismiss the notion, she put it on like another dress and wore it all the way to the park. The photographer was already there when she arrived, and he didn't notice her at first. He was taking pictures of a tree for some reason, circling it slowly like it was the bride, rotating the camera and fiddling with it, spinning the little dials, stopping every so often to frown with consternation at the sun, like he hadn't expected it to be out at 2 p.m. He wasn't a professional photographer, just a friend of Richard's who had always enjoyed taking pictures. This meant that his services were going to be cheap, and that was the most important thing. Maud and Richard's wedding album would not be passed down from generation to generation. It would merely sit on a coffee table for a few years until Maud and Richard were gone, and then someone would take the pictures out of it and throw them in the garbage, and the album, if it was lucky, would end up in a thrift store with a 25-cent sticker on it. This was Maud's first marriage, Richard's second, and neither of them had children. Their relationship wasn't the start of anything but itself. "Hi, Maud," said the photographer. "Hi," said Maud. She couldn't remember his name. "You look beautiful," said the photographer. "Liar," said Maud, laughing. "Take lots of pictures of us kissing and from behind. More of him than me. Maybe we could do a few of those funny ones where the bride holds her bouquet in front of her face." "Okay," said the photographer, looking uncomfortable. "Speaking of, why don't we start with some bridal portraits? I read that lots of brides like to have just a couple." "No, thank you," said Maud quickly. "None of just me." "Oh, okay. Sure, no problem. Sorry," said the photographer. He took another picture of the tree. "I'm just going to sit over there on that bench until my groom arrives," Maud said, giddy at the thought of Richard walking down the tree-lined path toward her, dressed in a suit, looking at her in that way he always did. Like she was an angel and Jane Fonda and the only woman left on planet Earth. She arranged her pretty dress around her on the park bench and patted her hair and ran her ring fingers under her eyes to check for stray flecks of mascara. And then she sat. And sat. And sat. Until she began to wonder if she had misunderstood Richard when he'd said they should meet at this park. But the photographer was here. What were the chances they'd both gotten it wrong? "Excuse me, Mr. Photographer," said Maud, a little embarrassed that she couldn't remember the young man's name. "I'm going to find a payphone. I'll be right back. If Richard gets here before I do, make him feel bad for being so late, will you?" She smiled to show she wasn't serious. "Okay," said the photographer, who did not appear to mind being called photographer. It even seemed to puff him up a bit. "Are there working payphones still?"
"Of course there are working payphones," Maud chuckled. "Not everyone has a cell phone in their pocket."
The photographer mumbled something about thinking that everybody did actually have a cell phone in their pocket, and Maud went off to find a working payphone. She was right. There was one just around the corner, and she punched Richard's number into it, feeling conspicuous. A wedding dress was, by design, a conspicuous thing to begin with. But usually, if you were wearing one, it meant that you did not have to be conspicuous all by yourself. Usually. The phone rang a few times. She wasn't upset yet, just a little concerned. If he answered, that would be bad. He lived 20 minutes out of town, and he was already late. If he didn't answer, though, that might be worse because, well, where was he?
"Hello?"
Okay. Bad, but not worse. "Richard," Maud exclaimed, "what are you still doing at home?"
"Maud. Oh, Maud."
He sounded surprised to hear her voice. Who did he think would be calling on the day of his wedding? She was quiet as she waited for a wave of emotion to pass. It was fine. Everything was fine. It was her wedding day. But then Richard wasn't here, so... Did you forget our wedding, Richard?" His voice rumbled over the phone line.
"See, yes, no, I didn't. No, I'm trying to think of that saying. Cold, something cold."
"Richard, are you okay?" He sounded off. His speech was slurred, and he seemed confused. She tried not to panic. "Richard? Richard?" What were you supposed to ask if you suspected a person was having a stroke? There was an acronym for it. FAST. That was it. Face, arms, something, something. It would come to her. Time was of the essence. "Okay, Richard. Face." This caused Richard to break into laughter.
"Cold face? No, cold face?"
He laughed so hard he struggled to form sentences.
"Cold feet, that's what it is, but no, that can't be it either. That's just absurd."
A gurgling sound traveled through the receiver, followed by an emphatic belch.
"Cold feet. Ah, Maud, my feet are too cold to get married. My feet..."
He was laughing too hard to finish the sentence.
"You're drunk,"
Maud said, surprising herself. She'd said the words before they'd even crossed her mind. She wasn't mad, not yet. She wasn't even sure she was awake. It could have been a dream. One of those ones where you're naked in front of a lot of people. Only she was the opposite of naked. She was overdressed. And her inebriated fiancé was laughing much too hard at an unfunny, age-old idiom that meant he didn't want to marry her. At any moment, she would flap her arms and fly away in the phone booth, and then she'd wake up on her wedding day and chuckle about it to herself, and maybe she'd tell Richard all about it later, on their honeymoon. They were going to Canmore. They had a honeymoon suite. They were going to drive into Banff one day and take a cableway ride to the top of Sulphur Mountain.
"No!"
yelled Richard, laughing again.
"Well, yes. Yes, that is true."
He was hysterical.
"I have to go, Maud. This whole thing..."
He hung up. So, there stood Maud in a phone booth on Scarth Street, utterly confused and abruptly overdressed. She was not heartbroken, but that would come when the shock wore off. This whole thing, absurd. Well said, Richard. It was not Maud's wedding day after all. She sent the photographer home and canceled the ceremony, and then she went home too and changed out of that stupid dress. As embarrassing a thing as it had been to put on in the first place, taking it off and trying to fit it back into its pretty box were downright humiliating. Then there was nothing to do but wait for Richard to sober up and call her with an apology and an explanation for his bizarre behavior. But he never did. There would be no cableway ride to the top of Sulphur Mountain. She knew she wasn't the first person to be left like that. Leaving was what people did best and most often. But the abruptness of this leaving, the unexplained nature of it, was torture. And it came as close to killing her as anything ever had. Her body became bloated with questions. She felt them in her feet when she walked, and they flowed through her veins and whispered in her head at night. She couldn't eat, couldn't sleep, couldn't concentrate. It was strangely, punishingly similar to being in love. It was awful, and it made her awful. Mackenzie and Tanya. But it's my birthday. Mackenzie stood in the bedroom doorway. She was trying to feel angry so she wouldn't feel hurt. Was yesterday. Tanya's voice floated in from the tree just outside the bedroom window. She'd been on her way down when Mackenzie caught her, and now she was perched on a branch, her bone-white skin glowing in the moonlight, so she looked like a ghost hovering there. That's not how it works. That's exactly how it works. It's 2 a.m. It's not anyone's birthday. Pretty sure it's a bajillion people's birthday. You know what I mean. Not yours. Tanya glanced down the tree. Not to see who was down there, but to indicate to Mackenzie that she wanted to join them. You just don't want to admit you're ditching me to go hang out with someone you like more on my birthday. Again, your birthday was yesterday. Go to bed. Wow. Thanks. Mackenzie tried to look hurt without pouting. But Tanya could only care about one thing at a time, and right now, Mackenzie wasn't it. Kenz, chill out. We had a party. We had fun. That was your birthday. This is something else. We don't have to share everything. I'm sorry you had to share anything with me. I'm sorry that's been so sucky for you. Tanya smiled impatiently. Okay, well, we gotta go. You're not going to tell, right? Be cool. Tanya was always telling Mackenzie to be cool, like it was something she had control over, like she'd chosen at birth to be a loser. Obviously, I'm not going to tell, said Mackenzie, trying to appear indifferent rather than devastated. Awesome, said Tanya, indifferent without even trying. She whispered something down the tree, and a whisper came back up to her. She twisted her body toward the tree trunk, reaching in the dark for an invisible branch, trusting it would be there even though she couldn't see it. Mackenzie realized in that moment how familiar this escape route had become to her sister. I don't think you should go, she said quickly. One last attempt. Tanya drew in an exaggerated breath. Mom would hate it if she knew you were going off with some guy you barely know. This got Tanya's attention. She changed direction and hauled herself back in through the window, climbing over her dresser and jumping onto the floor in front of Mackenzie. She landed without a sound somehow, like she was a shadow instead of a person. If Mackenzie were to attempt the exact same thing, everyone in the household would wake up and come running to see if a tree had fallen on the roof or if there had been an earthquake. What do you know about it? Tanya wasn't indifferent anymore. Mackenzie knew she had the upper hand now. She didn't want the upper hand, though. She just wanted to be invited. Not because they were threatened by her or because they felt like they had to invite her, but because they wanted her around. She stared at her sister, her eyes welling up with tears, trying to decide how to play it. Should she mention the thing she'd read in her sister's email? The crazy amount of money she knew Tanya had in her purse right now? The fact that she knew exactly where Tanya was going and who she was meeting. Nothing, she said finally, staring at her purple toenails. Why'd you say that then?
It was a guess. You guessed that I was going off with a guy I barely know? You're always going off with guys you barely know. You're always going off with everybody, and you never take me with you. She didn't want them to invite her because they felt sorry for her. But maybe that was just what it was going to take. Tanya relaxed. Her eyes became bored again. She was neither empathetic nor concerned. Later, Mackenzie. She climbed up onto her dresser and slipped out the window into the dark. And that was the last time Mackenzie ever saw her in real life. But she showed up in Mackenzie's dreams almost every night after that, and often began to materialize in her periphery in public places, looking just as ghostly and shadowy as she had the night she disappeared, only to vanish when Mackenzie turned her head. Suna and Brett. The stove might as well have blown up. The bathtub from the apartment above might as well have fallen through the ceiling and onto the dining table with a naked neighbor in it. The chicken they were eating might as well have reassembled itself and run screaming out the front door. The fight had had that kind of quality to it. It was shocking, surreal, unprecedented. Something they never thought would happen to them. And it did feel like something had happened to them, not something in which they had agency. They'd been having supper together, and then they were yelling at each other, then screaming. Who had started it? Who had become angry first, and why? Neither party could remember afterward. Two words ended the fight, one on each side. Brett called Suna jealous, and Suna called Brett fake. And though both women had used many worse words than those throughout the course of the fight, those were the ones that rang in the air like gunshots. As the saying goes, the truth hurts. Maybe the fight would have been the end of their relationship, but they'd been at Brett's house, and when Suna stormed out, she forgot to take her jacket. It wasn't a special jacket, but it was a jacket, and this was Toronto, and it was January. Suna had been angry enough to make it home that day without it, but she'd had to make a sheepish call the next morning to arrange a time to pick up her coat. When's good for you? Sorry I flew out like that. Sorry for everything, actually. She hadn't meant to apologize and didn't mean the apology. It had come out of her mouth like someone else had commandeered her voice box. She realized then that she was opening a door that had been a relief to slam shut. Of course, then, Brett had no choice but to apologize back. I know. I'm sorry, too. I was out of line. And Suna hated herself for saying the next thing, and for how whiny and pleading her voice sounded when she said it. Can we please just forget that happened? Like, all of it? I want to be friends again, like we were before all of this. Yes, me too. Brett sounded sincere, but Brett was a good actress. And then they sat there on the phone, and Suna knew both of them were thinking the same thing. How do adults end friendships? Suna and Brett had known each other for over a decade, had been each other's only support through all the usual 20-something milestones and heartbreaks. They'd gone to school together, worked together, lived together. They had history. Why would anyone want to end that kind of friendship? The kind only lucky people even got the chance to experience in the first place. It was almost ungrateful, wasn't it? But Suna showed up at Brett's apartment that afternoon, and they hugged, and said how relieved they were not to have lost each other. And Suna even found herself tearing up, and then wondering, do I mean all of this? I must. I'm crying. She got her coat, said goodbye, and felt a little better as she closed the door behind her. Everything was okay. This friendship was far from over. The cautious optimism lasted all the way to Ossington Station, where she stepped onto a subway car and sat ruefully beneath a massive banner that read, The 30 Under 35 Initiative. The future of Toronto is in great hands. It bore the radiant image of none other than her now unestranged friend, Brett, Toronto's most notable and upcoming VIP golden child. A role model for anyone even a second younger than her, an inspiration to everyone else. The ad spoke to Suna. It said, Look at this woman. Look at you. The friendship is over. But they disrupted the natural progression of things. That stupid jacket. They were friends again.
And now they met for coffee every week because they didn't know how adults ended friendships. The relationship was on life support. The coffee dates were torturous. Suda would ask politely about Brett's latest campaigns and sponsorships and speaking gigs. Brett would, in turn, lean across the table and lower her voice and put on her concerned face and speak to Suna the same way she spoke to her massive Instagram audience. "Suna," she would say, scrunching her forehead up like she was working hard to select every word that came out of her mouth. "I know your job makes you money, but does it make you happy? Are you in your BLZ?" That was Brett's problem. She couldn't even drop her act in casual conversation. She was always on. Always Brett Lynn Zaleschuk, creator of the social media empire Best Life Zone. Always there to help the commoners in their pathetic attempts to be like her. Suna hated it. But in the name of friendship, she would smile stiffly and assure Brett that she was in her BLZ, a statement that made her want to pour her hot coffee directly onto her own face. Occasionally, the women would reminisce about college, or one of them would share something hard or sad and the other would comfort her. And they'd both remember that this relationship, though now strained and warped, was important to each of them, and that it wasn't going away. They were like family. At the end of each appointment, out of some kind of weird, polite, mutually shared impulse, one of them would say, "I'll see you next week." And they'd make another date. Suna was early today. She snagged the last free table in the small coffee shop slash cocktail bar on Mutual Street and sipped a black coffee. Brett was 15 minutes late, then 20, then 30. Suna felt irritated. It was just like Brett to forget. She'd probably had something come up that seemed more important. Next time they got together, Suna would tell her off. This was the nice thing about crossing over from the carefulness and politeness of friendship into familial territory. Suna could always say how she felt. But, as it turned out, there would not be a next time. Brett didn't call to explain why she hadn't shown up or to offer any kind of apology. She didn't call at all. Their weekly coffee dates ceased. And a few weeks later, Suna noticed that Brett had unfollowed her on Instagram. The finality should have made her happy. But you don't get to choose your feelings, just like you don't get to choose your family. The last will and testament of Rebecca Finley. Larry. Larry Finley was not supposed to sell the house on Montreal Street, but he couldn't live in it either. It said so in the will. "To Larry Finley, I give my house on the condition that he does not A, sell it, or B, listen to any music produced after 1952 in it, or C, paint it, or D, plant flowers anywhere in the front yard, or E, go into the attic or allow anyone else to enter the attic, or F." The will went on and on like that. Almost a full alphabet of strange, mostly unexplained rules. Larry thought the whole thing was stupid. If he couldn't listen to his music in the house, he couldn't move into it. And if he couldn't live in a house or sell it, and if parts of it were off limits, and if the house came with more rules than a cult, what good exactly did it do him to inherit it? At first, a free house, it sounded great. But now, it just made him cranky. On his way home from the lawyer's office, he stopped at the deli counter at the grocery store for potato wedges. This was what he always did when he needed cheering up. It worked for two reasons. One, he liked potato wedges, and two, he liked Ange, the motherly cashier who always magically seemed to be working when he needed cheer-up wedges. "Hey there, Larry. How will you be paying?" Ange always smiled at him like she was relieved to see him, like she'd been waiting for him and was worried he wouldn't show. It made him feel like his presence all by itself was a good deed. He felt the same way about her, and always kind of wished he could tell her that. "Cash?" "Hey, Ange," he said, digging into his pocket for his wallet. "Yeah, cash." "You okay, Larry?" "Yeah, just a little bit grouchy. Sorry. I inherited a house today." Ange laughed through her nose. "Hate it when that happens." "Yeah, no,
The house is fine. It's nice. It's that big one on Montreal with the turret thing on top. They were gonna make it a historical site or something back in... Anyway, it was my aunt's, and it just comes with a lot of unreasonable obligations. She was kinda... He made a pained face.
Ange nodded.
I see. Well, if you want to offload it. Larry laughed. He knew how he sounded. She had a way of making him hear himself.
Thanks, Ange. I'll keep you in mind.
Someone placed a box of Cheerios on the conveyor belt at his elbow. Then he turned. A woman stood there, carefully moving groceries from the basket slung over her arm onto the counter like she was putting a puzzle together. She had small, close-set brown eyes and frizzy chin-length hair dyed bright blue, the color of 5-cent candy whales. Her face was decorated all over with tiny silver hoops and studs, and she was wearing army boots. She was perfect. She looked up and caught his eye.
Sounds like you come here often, she said,
then smiled at Ange.
Larry knew he had no business looking at beautiful people because he wasn't one of them. He was a thin man. Fast food, fast metabolism thin, not gym and protein shakes thin. He had acne scars all over his face and a goatee on his chin and an instantly discernible penchant for 80s and 90s era punk rock. He still wore a wallet chain. He was 43. He had no business looking, but he was looking anyway. He realized he was even staring and interrupted himself with a nervous laugh that sounded unfortunately like a squawk.
Every day, he said,
and then he felt embarrassed about admitting he was the kind of person who went to the grocery store every day. The squawk was not good either. Ange rescued him, and whether it was on purpose or not, he loved her for it.
Larry's my favorite customer, she said.
She probably said this about all her customers.
He always brings me the most interesting coins.
Larry tucked his chin into his chest and cleared his throat.
Ange collects coins, he explained.
I don't know anything about coin collecting. I just bring her anything that looks old or different. Oh, speaking of.
He reached into his coat pocket and pulled out the nickel he'd been saving for her.
This one's cool, he said,
forgetting about the beautiful, beautiful woman standing just inches from him.
Look at the edges, squared. It has 12 sides. Have you seen one like that before?
Ange nodded, grinning appreciatively as she tucked his potato wedges into a bag and traded them for the nickel.
Thanks, Larry. I'm excited to take a look at it.
As he turned to go, the woman behind him cleared her throat, and he glanced back at her. She was looking at him in a funny way, like she'd made the noise to get his attention, but now didn't know what to do with it.
I like your shirt, she said.
And though Larry was wearing a shirt, and though the woman was looking straight at the shirt he was wearing, it seemed impossible that she was saying this to him.
He looked at Ange for help.
Descendants,
Ange read, picking up on his distress.
Is that, it's a punk band, said the woman.
Then she looked Larry straight in the eyes and added,
Milo Goes to College is such a great album.
Larry had never fallen in love before. He'd always thought that would be an intentional, gradual process that could take weeks, months, or even years. He was well-versed in physical attraction and had had 1,000 crushes, meaningless and otherwise, but couldn't fathom what it would take to decide you loved someone. But as it turned out, falling in love was exactly what it sounded like. Love was like a sewer, something you knew about but didn't think about until someone left a manhole cover open and you just tripped right in and your stomach dropped like you were on a roller coaster and you felt thrilled but also like you were going to barf. Messy, painful, disorienting, amazing. It happened to Larry when he looked into her eyes. He got distracted, didn't watch where he was going, tripped over his feet and plunged, face first, straight into love. He nodded, unable to tear his eyes away from hers.
Can I have your phone number?
He asked breathlessly. The woman burst out laughing, which was good because Larry couldn't have recovered from such a massive gaffe if she thought he wasn't joking. But his relief lasted for only a moment. Then it occurred to him that laughter wasn't a great response to a request for a phone number if it was not followed by a phone number.
His phone started to buzz in his pocket, and again, he couldn't decide if that was good or bad. Good, probably. He needed to get away. It was over. He'd messed it up. He glanced down at the screen. Glenda. His older sister, returning the call he'd made on his way to the store to complain about the house and the will. Their aunt had left her a 1974 Lincoln Continental with no stipulations whatsoever. She could sit in it, she could drive it, she could look in the glove box. She could plant flowers in the trunk for all anyone cared. It wasn't fair. "Well," said Larry, holding the phone up, "I have to take this. It's the sister. I mean, it's my sister, not some random nun." He cleared his throat. "So, nice to meet you guys. I mean, not you, Ange." Ange looked like she wanted to save him again, but they both knew it was too late. He turned and walked away fast, holding the phone to his ear and clutching the potato wedges like a purse, thinking to himself that while he had enjoyed his brief encounter with love, he was probably going to need to avoid it from here on. It had taken everything out of him, and he'd come up with nothing in the end. He felt sorry for himself. First the house, now this. "Hey, Glenda," he said.
"How was it?"
"Weird. I got her house." Silence. "But Glenda, listen, it's not simple like that. There are a whole bunch of really weird rules that I have to follow if I want to keep it. Just ridiculous rules. Is that even allowed?"
"Is what allowed?"
To make such strange, specific rules and requests in your will. That can't be allowed, can it? Legally?" Glenda paused, the way she always did before she was about to play devil's advocate. Larry hated that pause.
"Well, I read somewhere that Napoleon Bonaparte's will said to shave his head and distribute the hair among his friends. If that's not strange and specific, I don't know what is. You could probably look into it, though. Ask the lawyer how much of it they can make you follow. What kind of rules did she put in there?"
"Well, I'm not allowed in the attic."
"Larry, you don't even want to go into the attic, do you? Not after what happened up there."
"No, I don't want to go into the attic. I want to be allowed to go into the attic. That's different. But here's another one, Glenda. I'm not allowed to plant flowers in the front yard."
"You were going to plant flowers?"
"Again, I just don't want to be told I couldn't if I wanted to. Glenda, I'm not even allowed to live in the house."
"What?" Glenda sounded either skeptical or giddy. "She said you can't live in it?"
"Well, she said I can't listen to my music in it."
"That's not the same thing at all."
"It is to me," said Larry solemnly.
"Don't whine, Larry," Glenda said in a voice all warbly and choppy. She probably had him on speakerphone. She couldn't just sit and take a phone call. She had to be doing something else at the same time. "She left you a house."
"I'm not whining. And she didn't leave me a house you can live in comfortably. You can listen to whatever you want in it, you can decorate it how you want and go into all the rooms. When you're done with it, you can sell it. She basically left me a really, really big box I can't get rid of. A box that people died in. A 2,000 square foot casket."
"Why don't you rent it out?"
Larry leaned against his car. Why hadn't that occurred to him? The upside of such specific rules was that there wasn't a lot of guesswork to be done. The rules did not state that someone else couldn't live in the house. It was a big house. Lots of people could live in it. He could stay where he was and collect enough rent to cover his living expenses, and then some. He could even quit his job. "Huh. I could maybe do that," he mumbled.
"It's a big house," Glenda said. She liked to read his mind and repeat his thoughts out loud like a psychic parrot. "You could fit lots of people in it. You could stay in your crappy little apartment and collect enough rent to quit your job."
He couldn't be sure, but he thought his sister sounded mad now.
"She always did like you and Jim best."
"Why? What did she leave Jim?"
"She gave him all those paintings of Uncle Garnet's, the landscapes. I mean, they're not going to make anyone rich, but they're nice. They'll look nice in his house. Meanwhile, I will drive my newly acquired boat straight to the dump because Aunt Rebecca apparently didn't like me."
"Glenda,
Larry.
Well, at least the Lincoln isn't haunted.
Larry.
Glenda.
But Larry was right. The Lincoln didn't have ghosts in the glove box. The house, however, was widely known to have at least two. One being, presumably, the ghost of his Uncle Garnet, who dragged a chest into the middle of the attic floor, climbed up on it, and hanged himself over 2 decades ago. The second being his business partner, who'd done the same thing right next to Uncle Garnet. Over the years, Aunt Rebecca had gotten used to the ghosts. She was always telling people what they wanted and what they didn't want, who they didn't want around, what kind of music they wanted to listen to, etc. They didn't like Larry's Uncle Ronnie, for example, so Ronnie was not allowed to visit. They were picky ghosts, she said, always shrugging apologetically. I like you, Ronnie, she said when she told him the bad news. But they make the rules in this house. Larry hadn't believed in the ghosts until the fall of 93. All the Finleys had been gathered around the dining room table, and someone had turned on the radio, and Celine Dion had started caterwauling like a banshee. Aunt Rebecca shook her head disapprovingly and said, That woman is caterwauling like a banshee. The ghosts won't like that. But no one turned the radio off. Then, the door to the attic started to open and close, and open and close. Bang, 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 bang. Aunt Rebecca made a face at her peas like, I told you so. AM 1190, she said, looking bored with their insolence. So someone turned the radio to AM 1190, where the Blue Jays were playing the Phillies. The banging stopped. The ghosts, it would seem, liked baseball. Sports ghosts. Aunt Rebecca sat back in her chair, smug and knowing, and said, The ghosts hate Celine Dion. From that point, all the Finleys believed in the ghosts. Larry believed in the ghosts, and he presumed now that the suicides and the subsequent ghosts were the reason he wasn't allowed in the attic. And they probably also had something to do with him not being allowed to sell the house or plant the flowers, if he were the kind of person who wanted to plant flowers. And they were the reason he would obey the orders in the will to the letter, even though the average person might choose to ignore them if they legally could. But the ghosts hadn't said he couldn't rent the house out. So Larry hired some contractors and turned the house into three separate suites, basement, main, and second floor. The ghosts left everyone alone during the process, though one worker claimed to have heard singing when everyone else had gone for their lunch break and he'd been there by himself. Larry took this to mean that they were happy with him for obeying the rules. And though Larry liked to give the impression that he disliked authority, he was actually an incurable people pleaser. In this case, an ex-people pleaser. On the last day of renovations, he checked the door to the attic, which was accessible from the second floor suite. It was locked, and the one key he'd been given, the key to the front door, didn't fit the lock. That was that, and it was fine with Larry. In fact, now that he was face to face with that door, remembering that day in 1993 and all the other incidents that had happened since, he only felt relief. He couldn't have slept in the house, even if he was allowed. He knew he wouldn't have a hard time renting the suites out. The neighborhood was established, safe, well-located. A short walk northwest to the downtown area, a shorter walk in the opposite direction to Wascana Lake. Montreal Street was quiet and wide and lined with old trees. And the house itself was pretty. Light blue with white trim, a big wooden porch, an enclosed widow's walk on the roof, and a 50-foot Manchurian ash in the front yard, the roots of which were beginning to break up through the city sidewalk. No flowers, just like the ghosts wanted. As he hammered a for-rent sign into the lawn, Larry thought about the woman from the grocery store. Maybe she needed a place to live. Just as quickly, though, he remembered her laughter, as though the mere thought of someone like her giving someone like him a phone number was so ludicrous it didn't even warrant an actual response. And they both knew it. The first renter called within a day and wanted to move in immediately. She was not the grocery store woman. Her name was Maud.
She was crispy and angular and partially obscured beneath a big foofy hat. She took the suite upstairs, 2139A. She looked old enough, but not sweet enough to be his grandmother, and brought with her a cat and a couch. She called it a Chesterfield. She seemed fragile and weepy and said these were the only possessions she could still look at without crying, that she'd finally just sold everything else. Larry didn't ask why, even though this statement seemed a bit leading, especially the way she whispered it into the air and then looked sideways at him to gauge his response. Before he left, she complimented him on his Hogan's Heroes t-shirt and said something about TV back when it was good. And he didn't have the heart to tell her that he'd purchased the shirt at a punk show, that the Heroes were a band he liked, that he had never seen a single episode of the ancient sitcom. A week later, a university student named Mackenzie moved into the basement suite, 2139C. Mackenzie was tall and bold and athletic, and she had purple-black hair and a colorful fine-line tattoo that ran from her elbow up her arm and into the sleeve of her t-shirt like dyed spider veins. She almost, but not quite, looked like someone who could have belonged to the beloved punk scene of his youth, though her tattoo sleeve was too delicate, her whole aesthetic too clean and polished and new-looking. It was a shame what had happened to punk. He tried not to be that guy who constantly thought about it, but he was. Mackenzie had even less furniture than Maud, like any kid who'd just moved out of her parents' house. But she had a ludicrous number of suitcases, like she needed a different shirt for every hour of every day. She and another girl around her age pulled up in two separate cars, hauling Mackenzie's stuff up the porch steps and down the basement stairs like two picnic ants. And then they stood on the porch talking and laughing for what must have been an hour, as Larry awkwardly stood by, waiting to hand off the door key. When the other girl finally left, she took a couple of empty suitcases with her. She also took Mackenzie's quiet confidence, and suddenly Mackenzie was only quiet. She no longer seemed like she fit in her own clothes and skin, like someone else had inhabited her body, dressed her and decorated her, and then left her, bewildered and lost, standing in someone else's ripped skinny jeans in front of someone else's house. She stuttered an almost inaudible thank you to Larry, took the key, and hurried into her apartment. Larry heard the door close and lock and bolt behind her. 2139B, the entire main floor, remained vacant for almost a month before it was occupied by a woman named Suna. She had long, shiny fingernails and short, shiny hair and white, shiny teeth lined up neatly in a mouth that smiled without alerting the rest of her face. She was extremely beautiful, but in a different way than the grocery store woman, where that woman could grace the cover of Larry's favorite punk magazine, Razor Cake. Suna was someone you'd see in a commercial for perfume or playing a lawyer in a TV drama. He and Suna hadn't gotten off to a great start. When he'd showed up to give her the house key, she'd grasped it gingerly between her thumb and middle finger like it was dirty, said a curt, "Thank you," and opened the door without even looking at him, though he continued to babble on about keys and mailboxes and the other women living in 2139A and 2139C. But still, every time his phone rang from that day forward, he hoped it was her, asking him to come fix the dishwasher or something. It wasn't love, but only because he was being more careful about love these days. He didn't mention the ghosts to any of the tenants. They'd find out soon enough. A letter arrives at 2139 Montreal Street. Suna. Suna had been transferred, and she was still trying not to take it personally. It wasn't that she wanted to stay. She wanted to leave more than anything. It was that she didn't want to be sent away. Leaving should be her idea, and people should beg her not to go. But Fire Fitness was expanding, with new locations in Saskatchewan and Alberta, and sending Suna to one of them made the most sense logistically. So Suna had to act sad to be leaving, but not too sad, lest they reconsider and decide to send someone else, when all she really felt was relief. She needed to be out of this city, where everyone knew Brett but not Suna, where Brett's face grinned from billboards and signs in the subway and from the stages she graced when she was asked to MC fancy events and charity dinners. This was Brett's city, and while Suna had long wished she didn't have to live here, she'd never had a good enough reason to leave. So, Suna flew west. And she spent much of that flight contemplating all the usual things people worried about when they were leaving anything for anything else, whether she was running away or toward, whether she had failed or outgrown, whether she was being stupidly impulsive or thrillingly spontaneous. By the time she landed in her new home, Regina, Saskatchewan, the Queen City, the actual center of the middle of nowhere, she'd landed on all the most unflattering conclusions. She was running away from Brett. She had failed at everything she'd ever attempted, and accepting this transfer was one big fear and failure-fueled mistake. But just because you knew you'd made a mistake, that didn't mean you knew how to fix it. And the cab from the airport to her hotel was only $15, where a flight back home would have been several hundred. And maybe there was something for her in this tiny city. Maybe it would be easier to find because it had so few places to hide. Within days, she'd found a more permanent, temporary place to live and was accepting a house key from a scrawny guy dressed like a 14-year-old who couldn't look her in the eye but wouldn't shut up about keys and mailboxes and the other tenants living above and below her. When she'd seen the listing for this gorgeous mansion-like home, he was not the sort of landlord she'd pictured greeting her at the front door. The letter came a week later, and she didn't think for one second that it was meant for her because she didn't have friends who communicated by snail mail. More accurately, she didn't have friends. When she left Toronto, there'd been a going-away party put on by a group of people she had once called her friends. They'd acted sad and said they'd keep in touch, but Suna didn't expect them to and wasn't bothered by the thought that they wouldn't. Her moving away wasn't the real end of those friendships. But it was tangible and easy for everyone to point to. As though she'd begun to dematerialize during a dinner party and no one had noticed until a voice from a seemingly empty chair said, "Well, I guess I'll be leaving now." So, this letter wouldn't be for her. It would be for one of the other renters. The landlord had mentioned that he planned on installing separate mailboxes and doorbells for each of the suites as soon as he could. He said he simply hadn't thought of it before and then apologized and apologized and apologized. People who apologized like that, like they were begging for reassurance, drove her nuts. She reached into the mailbox, rolling her shoulder up so her purse wouldn't fall to the porch. The envelope, along with a grocery store flyer and a door hanger advertisement, was sitting in several inches of rusty water. "Oh, gross," she said, holding the soused papers in front of her with the tips of her acrylic nails. There was a clucking sound behind her. "That mailbox is awful. We need to speak to Larry about it. Every time it rains, it fills up like a bathtub and wrecks my coupons." Suna looked up. An older woman stood there, shaking her head and cradling a grocery bag like it was an infant. She wore glasses on a beaded chain around her neck and a ridiculous Kentucky Derby-style cocktail hat on her head. The hat had a veritable bouquet of feathers and flowers on the side, and would have looked festive, except for the fact that it was all black, which meant the feathers looked like they'd come from a crow, and the flowers looked like they'd come from a funeral scene in a Tim Burton movie. Except for that strange gothic hat, everything about her was sharp and no nonsense, from her nose to her collarbones to the pleats in her pants. "Larry? The landlord?" said the woman. Her voice was sharp, too. "Oh, right, yeah, Larry," said Suna, embarrassed. "I'm Maud," said the woman. "I live above you." Her tone also seemed to say, "I am above you." "Right, I'm on the main floor. I'm Suna."
"Oh."
The woman's lip curled disdainfully, as though she didn't like names that couldn't be found in very old Canadian phone books. Suna looked down at the mess in her hands, holding it out so as not to drip rusty mailbox water on her shoes. "You're right, though. This is..." "Oh, what?"
"Hmm?"
said Maud, her eyes not moving from Suna's. The wind moved the feathers in her hat so they waved like wispy black fingers. "Look at this," said Suna. She peeled the soggy envelope out from the folds of the grocery store flyer and held it up so Maud could see. Half of this is gone. It's been ripped right off. I can't find the other half. What happened to...
I can't imagine, said Maud.
A dog? Mumbled Suna.
Well, obviously, said Maud,
who only a second before had not been able to imagine a dog or anything else. She snatched the flyer out of Suna's hands, disinterested in the letter. She turned to the page with the coupons, and her face collapsed into a heavy frown.
Look at this.
She held it up, and Suna saw that the flyer had suffered a similar fate to the letter.
We need to talk to Larry about this. They can't scan those coupons after they've been in water overnight, or after the barcode's been ripped off like that. Happens at least once a week. I've had to pay full price for several items I had a coupon for. In fact, I think Larry owes me money.
I'm not sure that's how it... Suna swallowed the words. It wasn't her business, and she got the feeling she didn't want it to be. She held out the sopping letter. Here, I think this letter is for you or the other tenant. It's not for me.
Why wouldn't it be for you? Because it's dirty? Because it's ripped?
No, just because I don't get mail, ever.
Whose name is on it?
Asked Maud. No one's. See? Half of it's gone. The address was probably on that half.
Then how did the mailman know to put it in our box?
I guess it must have happened after it was in our mailbox. That was frustrating. No dog could get into a mailbox and mangle the contents and then put some of it back. Was this the work of a mentally unhinged neighbor? Annoying teenagers thinking they were funny?
Oh, said Maud. Well then.
Yeah, said Suna. And she felt like she'd won some kind of silent fight. Maud scowled at Suna, and at the ash tree, and the sky. A car pulled up behind her with its radio blaring. It parked, and she turned and scowled at it, too. A girl with short hair slid out of the car. At first, she looked surprised to see people on the porch, then excited. She jogged up the sidewalk, stopping short at the porch steps. Her body was tall and wide, and she carried herself athletically but self-consciously, eager but full of nervous energy. She offered a funny little wave and smiled, oblivious to the tension between the other two women.
Hi, she said. I'm Mackenzie Simons. Are you the neighbors? I'm really happy to meet you. I've been wondering who else lived here. It's weird not knowing who all's in the same house as you, you know? It's strange.
She trailed off and her smile wavered slightly. Suna smiled back, trying to shake her annoyance with Maud. Hi, Mackenzie. I'm Suna. I'm on the main floor. This is Maud. She's upstairs. Maud nodded.
I wondered if I'd ever see either of you. And now here we are, all at the same time.
She sounded like she'd been waiting for this moment for a while, like she had something to get off her chest.
Good. I needed to talk to you both about your hours. Our.
Mackenzie's smile didn't falter when Maud cut her off.
Yes, hours. You leave and come back at strange hours. The doors in this house are loud. It wakes me up when you slam them.
She kept nodding emphatically as though pointing out the important words with her head. Suna opened her mouth to defend herself. She'd only been here a week and hadn't gone out except to get groceries or go to work, though she did leave very early for work. She taught classes at the gym as early as 5 a.m. That wasn't all that unheard of, though, was it? Lots of people had to leave early for work. And she didn't slam the door on her way out or anything. She wasn't a person who tiptoed around, but she wasn't inconsiderate. Mackenzie, however, was earnestly apologetic.
I do, don't I? She said. I'm really sorry. I have early morning classes and I usually work quite late. I'm so...
It's not a problem, Suna interjected. This is just how it is when you rent a suite instead of buying your own whole house. You're not loud, and you have as much right as either of us to close doors whenever you feel like it. You pay rent, too.
Maud gaped,
and Suna felt like she'd won again. Anyway, said Suna, we were just talking about this. She held up the dripping letter, still pinched between her fingernails. Found it in the mailbox. Half of it's gone. Weird, right? I don't think it's for me, and I thought I should check if either of you were expecting something before I read it.
Huh.
Mackenzie was polite but unconcerned.
I'm not expecting anything, and honestly, I don't know who'd write me a letter. Probably not mine.
They both looked at Maud. They were likely both thinking the same thing. Old people still write letters. Maud clucked her tongue again.
And I'm in the same boat as you two. Why don't you just read it? Then we'll know who it's for.
Okay, said Suna, unfolding the sopping paper.
Well, said Maud.
Suna frowned. Short and sweet, she said. Really short, actually, since half of it's missing. See? She held it out. The ink on the right side of the letter was bleeding and barely legible, but the left side of the letter was gone. I can't tell what all of it says. Suna held it closer to her face.
Read it, said Maud, out loud.
I literally just said I can't read it, said Suna.
I just meant, said Maud, her voice taut, that I want you to read whatever of it you can make out. You literally just said you can't really tell what all of it says. That literally means you can tell what some of it says. Maybe even most of it, if we are in fact being literal.
The women exchanged withering looks, and Mackenzie became singularly focused on a hangnail on her thumb. Fine, Suna said, trying to sound nonchalant. Half of it's missing, but... She cleared her throat and held the paper close to her face, squinting more than necessary. Okay, so the letter, what's left of it, says...
Is there a name? A salutation?
Maud interrupted.
Doing the best I can here, Maud,
Suna said, pressing her teeth together. An ache bloomed behind her ears.
No, there's no salutation. That would have been over here.
She pointed at the air where the left side of the letter would have been.
Annoying, said Maud.
Okay, I'm going to read this. Here, Maud.
Yes, fine, said Maud,
like she couldn't understand why Suna needed to spell it out like that. Go on.
Okay, said Suna, shaking some new tension out of her shoulders. Here it is. Ori, I missed you. I swung by on my way to... If you'd be here, but that was a long shot. Such a long time, and I'm sorry for that, too. My... Have some time that afternoon, and maybe we could... Cup? It's the one by the airport. If you were free...
Suna stopped. At the bottom of the letter, instead of a signature, there was a tiny letter B.
Could it be for her after all?
She remembered the way her stomach had dropped every time her phone beeped for months after Brett disappeared on her, with some mixture of hope and preemptive disappointment and anger. She remembered it vividly because for the first time in a while, she was experiencing it right now.
Keep going, said Maud.
She sounded anxious all of a sudden.
I can't, that's all there is.
A little water isn't going to make a whole letter illegible, said Maud stubbornly. Are you sure there's not more there?
No,
said Suna. Her anxiety was making her even more irritable. Maud, half of the letter is missing. Gone. Mackenzie's face bore the same eager expression as Maud's.
Can I see that?
She asked. But before Suna could hand it to her, Maud reached forward and snatched the letter, almost dropping her groceries on the ground. A little more of the paper tore off, but it was so soggy it made no sound.
I have an inkling this was meant for me,
Maud said. She spoke in a reverent whisper and moved toward the door, fumbling with her keys, the letter pinned between her elbow and her body, a damp spot growing on her coat.
Maud, I was trying to hand that to Mackenzie.
Mackenzie smiled gratefully.
Well, it's not for Mackenzie, said Maud. It's for me. I know exactly who wrote it.
You think you know who wrote it, said Suna. But maybe Mackenzie does too.
You can't just declare that it's yours and not let her look at it.
Maud glared at Suna. She looked Mackenzie up and down. At last, she sighed.
Fine, then. Come inside. It's too cold out here for this.
The shared entryway was a small room with three locked doors. Behind one was Suna's apartment, and behind the other two were staircases to Maud's and Mackenzie's. Maud unlocked the one on the right and tromped up the stairs, clutching the letter. Mackenzie and Suna followed at a safe distance, like Maud was a bomb.
At the top of the stairs was another door, and behind that, a living room with big naked windows and gleaming hardwood floors. Maud's square heels echoed throughout the room. A blue and white floral couch rested against the far wall, looking crumpled and out of place. A cat perched, statue still, on one of the cushions, contemplating the visitors. There was a TV-VCR combo on the floor with several precarious stacks of video cassette tapes on either side. This was what there was, and nothing else, not even a speck of dust.
"You're not moved in yet?" asked Mackenzie.
Maud didn't seem to hear the question. She had already disappeared into the kitchen. Suna and Mackenzie stood at the top of the stairs, unsure if they should follow.
"Come!"
Maud barked, her voice reverberating off the walls, and they scurried after her. The kitchen, like the living room, looked empty and unused. It smelled like bleach and lemons. The appliances and cupboards at least took up a little space, but the countertops gleamed, and the open shelves had nothing on them but a plastic salt and pepper set and a couple of plates. There was a dining table with four mismatched wooden chairs, and the bag of groceries Maud had been carrying was now on the floor by the refrigerator. Maud was already seated at the table, the letter in front of her, wrinkling up as it dried to match the hands holding it.
"Sit down," she said to Mackenzie.
Hunched over her dinner table with her black blouse and sharp chin, she reminded Suna of a vulture.
"What are you doing here?"
The question was for Suna.
"You said to come inside."
"I said for Mackenzie to come inside. This isn't your business."
Suna sat down defiantly.
"It's my mailbox, too. Possibly my letter."
Maud frowned but didn't press the issue. She set the letter in front of her and fixed her eyes on Mackenzie.
"I need to put my groceries away. Goodness knows everything's going to melt in there. But first we need to sort this nonsense out. Read it again."
Suna picked the letter up.
"I already read everything I could..."
"So read that again."
"Stop talking and I will."
Maud looked wounded, and Suna couldn't make herself feel bad about it. She cleared her throat.